Boundless Authenticity Podcast.
Rebecca Hardcastle Wright, PhD, is the co-creator of Exoconsciousness. She is a futurist, author, coach, and host of Exoconscious Humans TV. In 2016, Rebecca founded the Institute for Exoconsciousness, IXO, to advance experiencers' self-knowledge and co-creations. Exoconsciousness is the innate human ability to contact, communicate, and co-create with ETs, spiritual, and multidimensional beings. It advances emotional integration and psychic intelligence and promotes innovations to ease humanity's healthy transition into the post-disclosure era. A lifelong contactee, Rebecca's online individual and group exoconscious coaching and co-creative intensive strengthen and integrate participants' psychic experiences to advance their contributions, expertise, and leadership. Her newest book, Exoconscious Humans, Will Free Will Survive in an Increasingly Non-Human World, examines the future through the intersection of AI and psychic intelligence. Exoconscious Humans TV YouTube features tools and techniques for living a post-disclosure life. As a Washington, D.C. representative, Rebecca was a member of Apollo 14 astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell's Quantrek International Science Team, researching consciousness, the ET presence, and zero-point energy. Rebecca is also a therapist at Mind Body Medicine in Scottsdale, Arizona, specializing in healing trauma, the often unconscious root of disease, to generate health and longevity. Rebecca, thanks for being on Boundless Authenticity.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I want to learn more about self-sabotaging, an interesting topic.
Self-sabotage is not complex. But anyways, let's not take the focus off of your very insightful topic. Exoconsciousness. I mean, how did you come up with that name?
I didn't really come up with it. I've been an experiencer since childhood. So 3 years old is my first conscious memory of my contact. I had varied contact as a child, and I've always been able to, I guess you would say, see the unseen. And just recognize patterns and things that happened in life, and had a lot of psychic phenomenon around me. And that went on through my childhood. And then I went through a phase where I'm a mom and raising my children. And as they got older, we moved to Phoenix, Arizona. And at that point, I was able to move to a small town called Fountain Hills outside of Phoenix. And I for the first time in my life, joined a group of people who were like me, and they were experiencers. And that was a moment of great enlightening moment for me as an adult. And it seemed like being in that group, and many of those people are still my friends. Actually, the woman that was running it, Dr. Ruth Hover, she worked with John Mack at Harvard, and she and a couple other people were really put together the first peer group at Harvard, and we're trying to figure out how to work with experiencers and contactees in terms of being psychologists and sociologists. The woman who ran our group was a sociologist. She actually ended up at that time running the longest running experiencer group in the nation. She was extremely skilled. Unfortunately, she never wrote anything. So it's just mostly when I talk about her and the group. So I went through at this time when I was a single mom and I was reading a lot. She had this massive library. I had a lot of contact that was different from what I had during my childhood. And I was more or less, I guess you would say, saturated with contact, with reading books, with being in the group, with, for the first time, having friends who were also contactees. And so one morning, my alarm went off, and it was one of those kind of old time radio alarm clocks that you can hit the snooze button on. So I hit the snooze button and I thought, oh, I'll just fall back asleep here for 5 minutes. Got to get up, get the kids to school. I've got to go to work. It's going to be a busy day. My head went back, hit the pillow, and the word exoconsciousness came into me. It didn't come into my mind. It literally came into my entire body. I have a background in theology and philosophy and that quote in the Bible, and the word became flesh. That's exactly what happened to me. I had a word become flesh moment, and I knew right then that I was to work with consciousness, and that exoconsciousness was the word I was given, and that I was to move that out into talking with other experiencers, moving it out into the culture. And so I didn't really create it. It was given to me.
Good answer. I mean, I could go so many directions now with this. I have so many questions, especially about your first contact, because you made the distinction. You said that you experience different kinds of contact compared to right. Your first one. Right.
So my childhood contact was actually very complex, I think. I work with a lot of contactees. I do a lot of coaching and therapy with contactees. My early contact was rather complex, I think, for a young child. And I don't know why that happened, but that's just how I came in. Maybe I had an agreement to come in like that. But I simultaneously had contact with craft. So I was taken aboard craft. Beings came in my bedroom, which is very common. You know, I was at, I guess you would call it star school, where I was on board craft. I was meeting people. I was meeting beings. I was being trained. I was learning things. And then simultaneously, I was being pulled under the ground by beings. And I had very vivid memories as a child of being pulled under the ground and then being actually popping back up out of that sphere. And I was raised in Clarksburg, West Virginia, and it's a mining town. So it's a very porous kind of ground. It's not really empty. There's all kinds of caverns and coal mines and open porous veins within it. And I knew even as a child that what I was experiencing in the craft and what I was experiencing under the ground were connected. I didn't know how they were connected, but I knew that there was some phenomenon that was related that I was going through. So I've always been very, it's funny, it was not until adulthood I remember distinctly, I was sitting on the porch in Fountain Hills of my little apartment, and I was reading a book on shamanic work, and all of a sudden, it took me that long, I was like, oh my goodness, like I was doing shamanic work as a child with no training. I had no idea what I was doing. I just knew to go that, you know, when I was called that I would go underground and work with these earth energies, with these beings. And the same thing when I would go up in the craft. But those were different energies that I was working with then.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, I guess now is the best time to have you give us a short description of what exoconsciousness really is, because I'm sure that while you could give us that definition, people will better unpack the meaning afterwards when we get into other questions, you know?
Okay. So originally, I've been in ufology for a long time, you know, professionally, several decades. And it's very different today because we have, we're once again going through congressional hearings, and there's a lot of CIA and government involvement, which of course there always was. But in terms of contactees, there was an attempt in the early 2000s to try and become acceptable to academia. A lot of people within ufology, myself included, we thought it was time for ufology to be taught in the universities. This was a topic that needed to be integrated into many topics, not just science, but also a cultural and religion, certainly. And so my first definition of exoconsciousness was that it was the extraterrestrial abilities and extraterrestrial orientation, abilities, and dimensions of human consciousness. Because I wanted to make it a study. I wanted to say how we study. So then I wrote my first book, Exoconsciousness, Your 21st Century Mind, to really be able to expand on what that meant as something that could be an academic discipline about our human consciousness, but more of an objective approach. And then as I aged into knowing exoconsciousness, it became very clear to me that, of course, universities were not interested and that I needed to move on, that this was not really something that was going to be accepted as an academic subject. I had taught at a university before, so I knew how to develop curriculum. As a matter of fact, during this era in 2005, I taught one of the first ufology courses in the nation at Scottsdale Community College called Extraterrestrial Reality. So I knew how to create course content around this subject matter. That, by the way, only lasted for a semester, and then someone complained to the president, so they canceled it. But it still happened. And so then I started working more directly with contactees. I got my PhD in parapsychic sciences. I got my certification in hypnotherapy. And I started working as a hypnotherapist doing regressions. And I started working with kind of a mastermind group of contactees that I formed from all around the world. It was a really fun time for us to be together to support one another. And I redefined exoconsciousness at that time. And I said that it was exoconsciousness is the innate human ability. So it's innate. So every human has it. The innate human ability to connect, communicate, and co-create with extraterrestrials, multidimensionals, and spiritual beings. Mm. So I wanted to be very expansive in that because I run exoconscious coaching. I run groups. I also do one-on-one exoconscious coaching. And the thing I found is that people come to that who've had extraterrestrial encounters, and people come who see light beings, multidimensional beings. And then people also come who've seen Buddha and Jesus and Mary. So they're all the same, and they just want a chance to talk about and to explore what was happening to them and what was occurring in their life. And then we do a lot of work on integrating. So I believe that once a person has an encounter, it's so important that they integrate it within their entire life. All facets of their life.
Right. So exoconscious coaching is essentially just the same process of integration as it would be with any other like trauma-based healing work or something like that, right?
Right. Absolutely. Okay. Yes.
Okay. So I got to ask you though, it's kind of like a chicken or the egg thing. Is psychic ability a requirement for multidimensional contact or exoconsciousness, or how does that work?
if a person is having a psychic encounter, is having an extraterrestrial encounter, then they are psychic. They're seeing what other people can't see. They're seeing the unseen. Right. They're maybe, but it goes the gamut of our human senses. They may be smelling things. They may be seeing things, which is the dominant. They may be just hearing voices. A lot of times people just hear voices.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So, I mean, I feel like I have so many questions. I think what I really want to find out is how does a person really go about tapping into that innate ability as you described it? Is it something that has to be initiated by the beings coming to you, or can you consciously do it?
I think some people, like myself, obviously have some kind of a contract coming in like this. And many of us are keenly aware of, even before we were born, and many people I know talk about being crib contactees. They came in from other dimensions, other star systems, other extraterrestrial civilizations to bring forth this information on the Earth. So there's that person. I would be part of what Dolores Cannon would call the first wave. She talked about people coming in. I'm a first waver. And then there are people that maybe their blueprint doesn't open until later. So let's say that there's some kind of a cosmic blueprint in our DNA that we all hold, and that this psychic element of our DNA or of our energetic body, could be both, either or both, that it doesn't come online until later. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it comes online gradually, and then people will start meditating. They'll start doing yoga, maybe. They'll start maybe they'll get sick and they'll go to different healers, and they'll experience energetic healing. And as this just grows and grows, then gently, eventually, oftentimes they have an experience.
Hmm. And this is experience really just a part
then, of... as you say, you need to integrate it. Then this is another step for you then.
Right. So it's just like the typical spiritual journey that people talk about, where they're kind of offline, like you said, up until a certain age, and then something happens that triggers that, and all of their dormant DNA awakens, and they are able to. Okay, that makes sense to me.
And I was very so. I went to Boston University School of Theology, and I'm an ordained United Methodist minister, and I've been in the church, you know, my whole childhood was in the church. And then growing up professionally, I was a chaplain at a university, an ecumenical chaplain at a university. And I was always bothered by the fact that no one was really allowed to talk about their religious experience. It's kind of like you went there and everything's institutionalized and sanitized, and, you know, you follow the lexicon and read the scripture for the day, or, you know, you listen to what the clergy person had to say up in the pulpit. But there were, you know, Bible studies, but a Bible study, you always had to talk about the Bible study. So there just never was any room for anyone to talk about their subjective personal encounters. And so that's really why I started the Exoconscious Coaching, because I've had angelic encounters, and people that have angelic encounters or see Mother Mary or see Buddha, that's the same type of encounter as seeing an extraterrestrial.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I've seen quite a few, and it hasn't just been with my eyes open, it's been in meditation as well. And so when I first started seeing them a lot, but I also had like what you call like a kind of a crib contact. Mm-hmm. And it came in the form of a recurring dream for almost 10 years of my childhood. And it would just keep coming back. And so I was an offline person, like what we were just talking about. And I really started experiencing my spiritual awakening around age 24. I started to ask different questions in life. We started wanting to do different things. And it almost drove me crazy, actually. I could easily have not been here anymore, basically. But it was through, I guess what people would call a near-death experience, that I really woke up and felt a huge shift. And after that experience, I began to have that recurring dream again. And at first, I thought it was very bizarre that it started happening again, but it would always be the same dream. Like a craft would come down above my house, and there would be nothing but white light saturating everything, and I would be taken up into the ship, and it would be a very comforting feeling, and they would just be showing me around, and I guess this craft had some kind of a window, because they would be like, look out there, and you could see the earth, and things like that, you know? And there's a block on just about everything else going on with it. I've been trying to figure it out for years now, and it still doesn't go any further than that. So obviously there's some things that I must not be ready to remember. But this topic is very fascinating to me, especially at this time where things are changing. And with the most recent disclosure, I just talked with Neil about that topic. I mean, it's never been a better time for people who have had contact to come out and say, okay, thank God I can finally talk about this without being ridiculed, you know?
Have you gone to regression? Have you done regression?
I have not done any regression. I've just been trying to do everything on my own.
Oh. I did regression. I did regression as an adult, and it gave me, first of all, a little different experience, because I was going to, what I was doing, my path was, I became a hypnotherapist. So I went to Southwest Institute for Healing Arts and signed up in their hypnotherapy program. And so we basically were trancing ourselves all the time, because they're very experiential, hands-on. And as a result of that, I got to know people that I trusted in regression. And the regression helped me, because at that time I felt like I had opened so much and I'd gotten so excited, but things weren't really happening, and I needed to settle myself down. I needed to start to be more patient and kind with myself about it. And actually doing the regression helped me in that, because that often happens to experiencers. We either get frustrated or we get impatient. And yeah. It didn't give me a lot of answers, but it gave me enough answers that it helped me get over that, that plateau of being overly anxious. And I'll give you an example. So I lived in Phoenix, and in 1997, they had the Phoenix Lights. So large national, large sighting. And my friend Lynn Kitai is the main key witness in that. And she and I are good friends. And I was in her movie, The Phoenix Lights. But this is very interesting. I never saw The Phoenix Lights. Yeah. I had all these friends that were in, they were all into ufology, and they were like light experts, and they were doing, they were experiencers. Nobody called me. Nobody said anything. I didn't get a message to go outside. I never saw the Phoenix Lights. And so I looked at that experience and I thought, that's interesting. But then again, I thought, had I seen the Phoenix Lights, I would have become a craft researcher.
That's very interesting.
And since I didn't, I'm not. I've always been in consciousness. Mm-hmm. So things are planned for us, but being in consciousness, there's been these waves where I think ufology and craft research have really taken off, like right now, for example, but consciousness, not as much. So there was an impatience on my part.
I can relate to the impatience. I mean, I've not had anybody formally regress me, but I've been trying to regress myself. Like you said, just putting myself into trance all the time. It's a part of my work, so it's something that I've had to learn to do. And when I first started doing it, I started having dreams again. And that seems to be the primary way in which these beings contact me. And I mean, I knew about things that were coming, like COVID, all kinds of things that they told me about in my dreams. Yeah. And so every once in a while, I'll get a visit here or there, and they'll show me some stuff, and I'll be grumpy. I'll be like, oh, why are you showing me that? What am I supposed to do about it? You know? And that's how it goes. And when I initially, I think I lost my train of thought, actually, there. When I initially started trying to regress myself, that was when the dream started coming back, that first dream from childhood. And it just won't go any further. So I really do need to go see someone who can try to take me further on that. But just as a segue into my next question, I mean, with all of the people who are coming out saying, I've experienced contact in one way or another, how is that going to affect the government narrative on disclosure?
The government narrative on disclosure has an agenda behind it. It's more of, you know, we can either empower and trust in the government, or we can empower and trust our inner self. Mm-hmm. And right now, the formal government narrative is about trusting the government. You know, we want to know, you know, the military is going to tell us the truth, or the CIA guys are all going to tell us the truth, or, you know, this, some, you know, guy on the rooftop of Harvard is going to tell us the truth. So it's all Diana Pasulka has a really good video out, and she says that what we're going through now is the institutionalization of ufology. Hmm. So in church history, we'll just take Christianity since I'm a Christian. So in church history, when Jesus died, there were a group who lived into that experience of Jesus. And many of them were called Gnostics. Okay. And then into like the 50s and certainly the 300 AD, Council of Nicaea, they began to say, we'll take these writings about Jesus, but these other Gnostic writings, we're going to throw them out. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be relevant. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, when you look at the question that you asked me, how are experiencers going to influence the government? There's a historical precedence for the fact that we may be marginalized. Mm-hmm. And their purpose may be to marginalize us.
I think so, too.
Because what's happening with experiencers is that we're actually creating a new timeline for Earth. Mm-hmm. And that's the last thing they want. They want the old timeline. Like, stay on the old timeline. So,
yeah, you're right.
There's a lot of control going on. And in their defense, they're talking about the government, talking about the military. They hold within themselves the quote, make themselves responsible for, quote, the protection of planet Earth. So, of course, they're going to see everything as a threat. And they're going to have secrets because everything's about national defense.
Right.
And that's what's happening right now. It's that's the narrative. That's who's getting all the UFO Twitter. That's who everyone's following, because we like to follow leaders in government. Mm-hmm. If you're a Democrat or Republican, you just like the government. And people like that. We're not as a human species yet. We're not really accustomed to trusting ourselves instead of trusting the government. So
you're so right.
Yeah,
that's been taken away from us at seemingly a subconscious level.
Well, I don't think it's been taken away. I think we've let them have it. So it's funny. My husband and I went on a road trip. Just recently, and we were coming back through New Orleans, through I-10 through New Orleans. And it was made me kind of sad when I looked at New Orleans, because, you know, Katrina, despite all the stories and all the movie stars that went down there and bought houses, who I'm sure subsequently sold them. what happened in Katrina was that Katrina came through, their homes were ruined, and yet people chose to go right back there and live again, knowing that it's in the target of a hurricane, that it's a city below sea level. And I think, you know, that's kind of, once again, not only do we give ourselves over to government authorities, we give ourselves over to our familiar.
Yes.
And that's the biggest hurdle to get over. It's to say, I can trust myself. For example, I'm just using it as an example. I can leave New Orleans. New Orleans is going to be fine. It's going to be fine without me. I can move on. I can go somewhere else. But that's a huge hurdle.
Right. Yeah. So true. I mean, the power of choice, we all have it, but we don't know how to employ it, I suppose. Which brings me to another interesting question. Your book is called the tagline is, "Will Free Will Survive in an Increasingly Non-Human World?" I mean, what do you consider non-human? I know that transhumanism is a thing, and there's a lot of people out there that are worried that the ET thing and transhumanism will be the same thing, and AI and all of that are going to be linked together, and there's a lot of fear around that, and I think that the media does a really good job of drumming that up as well. Now, what's your comments on that?
Well, I started writing that book, actually it was published, I think, in 2021, and when I gave it over to my publisher, he goes, "Yeah, Rebecca, I'll publish this book, but nobody's going to read it for 3 years." And I went, "What?" He goes, "Oh no, they can't handle this stuff." But the book was really birthed when I was in Washington, D.C. I was working for Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo 14 astronaut. And I just started hearing things. This is like back in, 2014, 2013. And I started hearing all these, quote, plans. People, I'm really friendly. People tell me things. They just kind of drop the information on my lap. And all of a sudden, I saw this whole transhuman agenda, and I saw the whole technocracy agenda, which is, a whole different type of, but really it's a technocracy agenda more so than transhuman, but it's both. It's engineering humans in a way that they're enhanced by technology. You know, it's just another excuse. So as we were talking about before, humans don't trust themselves. So someone comes along and says, "Have I got the implant for you?" Humans are going to take the implant. They just do. It's what humans do. We don't have to do that, but it is what we do. And I got so scared researching this book that I had to just quit. And so in like 2017, then my husband and I moved back to Phoenix, and it was a godsend for me because I let go. I thought, I can't write the book. I'm too traumatized by all this information. It's too much for me. And we ended up moving two times here in Phoenix. So there was a lot of movement going on. And finally, when I settled down, then I could write the book. But I wrote it from the standpoint that, you know, we can move into transhumanism, which is, you know, bottom line, it's hive mind. Call it what you want, it's hive mind. And there are races that are hive minded. And we could become a hive minded race, economically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. And I wrote the book juxtaposing exoconscious humans to transhumans and trying to offer being an exoconscious human, being on a different timeline as an option to going with the masses and becoming a hive mind.
Yeah. That's such a scary prospect because that seems to be what we do as humans for the most part. There's a large percentage of us that just follow the herd no matter what. Doesn't matter if it's going to lead us directly to pain or not. And that's a very scary thing. Very scary.
So it's really interesting to talking about dreams and knowing things in your dreams. So I'd been writing the book and I knew something that there was going, and I knew enough about biochemical warfare living in DC that I knew that those drums were beating. And so on New Year's Day of 2020, so January 1st, 2020, a voice just came to me and said, "You will be quarantined." And I rolled over to my husband. I went, "We're going to get quarantined." And he goes, "Oh, okay." He's like, he's such a cool guy. He goes, "Okay." And so I went across the street and asked my Mormon neighbors about it. And I said, "Hey, I got this message. We're going to be quarantined. Do you have any ideas?" And they're like, "Oh, sorry. You know, we don't really do that. So my husband and I just kind of started quietly preparing. And then when it hit, I'm like, everything in the book was like, oh, they did it. Right. They pulled off everything in the book, genetic engineering.
Yeah, that's another topic we could go down, but that's already gotten me a couple of strikes, so maybe we should not.
I get it.
Yeah.
The hive mind didn't like it.
No, they did not. I mean, that brings me to the topic of the mind control. I feel like this is the planet of mind control, where we're just being lured in by a carrot on a string all the time, and most people kind of have an idea that something's going on, but they're just not interested in really finding out what that is. So it makes me wonder what kind of a world is going to be around for my children in the future with that kind of thing. I mean, that's the whole point of this podcast, to get people to try to at least understand. I can't make you do anything, but at least try to understand the various things that are affecting the development of human consciousness so that we can make better choices, maybe. Maybe not, you know?
Yeah, we are mind control. I said earlier about the minister in the pulpit. I mean, that's mind control. Like your eyes are going up.
Yep.
You're listening to every word that's spoken. Yeah. I mean, mind control is ancient. It's been around forever. But my book, I go a lot into the Tavistock and the Macy conferences. And it seems like psychiatry and psychology and sociology have been so complicit in controlling, in giving government and the government and the military and the intel the tools with which to control human behavior. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, that's so true. That, you know, spilled over into social media, of course.
Absolutely.
And I would add that not everyone is mind controlled.
Right.
There are a lot of people that refuse to be mind controlled. And there are a lot of people that stand for, so I talk a lot in my book about sovereign moral authority, that I, as a human, have a sovereign moral authority. And it was interesting. So we just went through the 4th of July and people were posting on Twitter about the men who signed their names to the Declaration of Independence, knowing that we never hear about this, but they did that knowing that they would be branded traitors, and how many of them had ruined lives because of that. Their family was killed. They were killed. They were imprisoned. They were bankrupted. It was something that they stood on principle, and it was not a pretty story. And it's a story that doesn't match the narrative. And so, once again, it's been hidden from us.
Yeah. Yep. It seems to be the way it goes. No, go ahead.
I was going to say that I think these times we're living in, that I would say for me personally, coming into this time is that maybe I, as a soul, wanted to develop a stronger spiritual spine. And maybe from other past lives, I had skills in different avenues of my spiritual spine. And now this is a whole new ball game now with artificial intelligence, with transhumanism, with central bank digital currencies. We are looking at a vastly different landscape.
Yeah. So true. I mean, I don't want to keep you very much longer because I know you got to run off to your exoconscious coaching session, but all of those topics you just raised are things that maybe I could have you back on to talk about again in greater detail.
Yeah.
Because we need to know these things. And what really got me turned on to your work was through Portal to Ascension. I watched it just out of sheer luck. I saw it there, and I had been putting the intention out that I wanted to find someone that was talking about this topic. I didn't know that it had a cool name like exoconsciousness or anything yet, but there you were.
Yeah.
And Neil had you on, and I loved everything you were saying, and I find that it's just not something that's being addressed at this time by very many other people. And if they are, it's not in a truthful way. It's kind of in a way to influence people in a negative direction.
Yeah.
Well, so thank you for your work.
Yeah, thank you. You and I are very similar, because what traumatized me most about writing my last book was that I got so traumatized because what was going to happen to my children and grandchildren. Mm-hmm. What was going to happen to humans, but specifically my own family.
Yeah. It bothers me. Yeah, at the very least, I just don't want that when my child looks me in the face and says, "Daddy, why is the world so screwed up?" I don't have an answer for it, you know? I can at least be like, I tried my best.
Right, I tried my best. Yeah, and that's really all we can do. And, it's also their souls and what they need to experience that we have to be respectful of also.
Yeah.
Which makes it a different kind of walk.
That makes it so much more difficult, right?
Yeah. I mean, maybe they want to come in and, you know, maybe my child wants to come in and be a cyborg. I don't know. I think that, I don't know, but I think we're on the edge of some very challenging questions, especially about the human soul and how far you can push this transhumanism into capturing human souls. Those are really deep questions. This is some of the questions that we talk about in our exoconscious coaching groups.
Yeah, that is a really deep set of questions going into. You're going to encourage me to ask you more questions.
And once you lose your soul and your soul's captured, how do you get it back?
That is a very important question. And while I got you here, I will bring that up because I've noticed that in working with people and in dealing with family members and friends and extended friend circles and things like that, all of the people who've gotten the you-know-what, they're experiencing personality changes. They're developing what I would like to call straight up malfunctions with their cognitive abilities. They're developing anxiety, depression, bipolar. They are displaying greater narcissistic tendencies. It seems like there's a light off and it just gets dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. And in some cases, some people don't have their light at all anymore. Yeah. It's very scary to watch. Yeah.
That's sabotage right there.
Yeah.
Self-sabotage right there. And even all the information that comes out on Twitter, like from Highwire and RFK's Children's Defense Fund, all of that information, in a sense, kind of feeds this, because I think people see that information and then they just give up. It's like, it's too late. You know, I've gone, you know, 4 or 5 rounds with this, so it's just too late for me. And so then they just give up.
Yeah, I see that a lot. I've seen that a lot with my coaching clients where you can't give them too much education too soon or they shut down. You can't really be explicit about a lot of things. There's that difference between openness and receptivity, and there's a fine line. If you cross that line because a person seems open but they're not receptive, you mess the whole thing up. It's like poking holes in the bottom of a ship.
Yeah.
It's
a good example. So, you have to let them lead. Let them lead the way.
Yeah.
Patience.
Yep.
People used to name their kids Patience. Like the Puritans, they used to name their kids Patience. It's kind of a cool thing.
Yeah. Yeah. We need to bring that back, I think.
Yeah, bring that back again.
Anyways, Rebecca, I don't want to keep you for too much longer because I know you have important work to do. We will have to do a part 2 to this interview.
Absolutely.
And talk about those things.
Let me know.
It's been my pleasure
Thank
to talk
you.
With you.
Best
Tell
of-
everyone where they can find you.
Okay, exoconsciousness.com, so EXO and then consciousness .com. It's got information about my exoconscious coaching, 101, the groups that I run. And we're also in the beginning stages of putting together an exoconscious pathways program that people can come in at any juncture and join, and strengthening our, we're a community.
Right. All right. Thanks for being on the Boundless Authenticity Podcast.
Thank you. Lovely to meet you.
It's amazing to meet you.
You're listening to the Boundless Authenticity Podcast, where we discuss everything related to the evolution of human consciousness.
At the very least, people need to understand that the United States builds bunkers, which are basically cities underground every 3 months.
Basically, when you dream, you tap into your subconscious. It is your nocturnal intuition, your creativity and imagination unchained from conscious reason, ego, and logic.
We live in a multidimensional reality, whether it comes through esoteric information in the spiritual realms or the UFO people experiencers, or mainstream through quantum physics and through mainstream science now realizing that parallel dimensions probably exist.
We're all spiritual beings. We're all having these human experiences. We've heard that phrase over and over and over. But what does that really mean?
You know, all the big questions of life, we have these answers inside of our souls.
We're ultimately studying the nature of what it is to be human, good and evil. Our psychology, how we think, and our health. That's why I love Bruce Lee's great quote, all knowledge is ultimately self-knowledge.
The Boundless Authenticity Podcast.